Hi, and welcome to this episode of Forest for the Future, the podcast where we explore innovation and challenges and ideas that are shaping the future of sustainable forestry, responsible sourcing, and, of course, FSC. Today, we are going to dive into a topic that sits in the heart of the FSC certification system. We are going to talk about the revision of the FSC chain of custody standards, or should I say standards? Because this is a framework that ensures that materials with the FSC labeled are tracked through every single step of a supply chain from forest to final product. And it is comprised currently of three different standards. And this is not a small update. The ongoing revision will bring some significant changes into how the system works and how companies experience certification when they are faced with it on the ground. Among the biggest shift under discussion is collapsing the multiple standards into one unified version and also strengthening social requirements. To guide us through what is on the table and all of the changes suggested and what they could mean for FSC certificate holders, for auditors, and for consumers, I have invited Cesar Gonsalves, Program Manager for Control Wood at Chain of Custody in FSC, who is also leading this revision process, and his colleague Emily White, who is a policy manager for the same area, focusing especially on social elements of the revision process. We will talk about the major changes suggested for the consultation, the reasoning behind them, and how they aim to make the system more robust, more flexible, and more fit for the future. And just so you know, this is the first of two episodes exploring the chain of custody revision. In the next one, we will look at reclaimed materials and circular business models within FSC, but that's a story for another day. Today, we focus on the overall picture and on the social requirements for workers in FSC chain of custody. So let's dive in. Cesar, welcome to the podcast again. Can you start out by just setting the scene for us? What is it that we are revising right now? And why did FSC decide that it was time to actually update the chain of custody standard?
So first of all, this is a joint revision process, right? So it includes the core standard for chain of custody, what we know by 40.004, alongside with some complementary standards, such as multi-site and group certification, 40.03, sourcing reclaimed materials, 40.07, and finally, the standard that is applicable to certification bodies and auditors. And of course, there's also a few associated procedures. I believe it's 8 documents in total, if I'm not mistaken. And to your second question, so actually, the current version of the core standards, 40.04, was made effective back in 2021. The version that we are working on will be effective only in 2027. So it's more than the recommended 5 years interval between two versions. Some of the complementary standards have not been revised for over 10 years. So we thought it was a good time to make this revision, including all the standards that were mentioned, and at once in a coherent way.
Mm-hmm. What actually happens in between standard revision periods? Is everything just locked in between those periods, or can we adapt things here and there if we need to? I mean, 10 years for not revising a standard is pretty long.
We can adapt things, and we do have a mechanism for it, which is an advice note. So we only use it in cases where it's really needed, and that topic doesn't require fundamental change into the document. So it's considered a faster mechanism to make those changes. Out of curiosity, actually, those standards that have not been revised for a while actually didn't have any kind of change. They didn't require a change via an advice note, which is interesting. We can look from the perspective that the standards are still relevant to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. What happens to the advice notes then when we have these revision processes?
So most of the advice notes, they tend to be included, or let me phrase it as addressed, because we may keep the same concept as we had when we first drafted that advice note, or we can take a slightly different approach because we have more time to reflect on the implications, on how it is perceived by the affected stakeholders. But in essence, we try to address most of the advice notes. Of course, some of them, there's still a value for them to be kept as a standalone because they refer to very specific situations. And it's not the purpose of a standard to include every single thing across all kind of sectors, scenarios, countries, and so forth. So we will have a mix of both with this revision process. Some will be included, some others will be left as standalone.
Okay. So I assume that some of those would also be topics, bigger topics that we look into as part of this revision process. Can you actually help us understand a bit more how we choose which topics are we actually focusing on in a revision process? Where do we know what to change? Who identify these topics? Do we ask ahead? Do we capture data along all of those 5 to 10 years? Do we know from audits? How do we know what to change?
Mm-hmm. So topics from our revision, they may come from many different sources. There's no single source of information. We, in between revisions, we look to the reoccurrence inquiries, interpretations requests by our certificate holders, by our certification bodies. We also look into cases of disputes, integrity reports, pilot projects, and even research papers. So it's a collection of resources that we use. And then we had what we call the conceptual phase, which was essentially a year where we held some workshops and also we prepared the report to get some feedback from stakeholders, for the stakeholders also to point us to what it is more important to be addressed.
What were some of the things that they pointed to there?
So we have, I could say, dozens of topics, actually. Some are big, some others are small, but even those small ones, maybe they have quite an importance for certain sectors or specific activity scopes. But we have, for example, expansion of the remote auditing and hybrids, the possibility of remote and hybrid audits. We have a simplification of the process on how to identify false claims and how to address those. We have also the expansion of the thresholds for group certification to be able to include more companies in those groups, for them to be supported by the central offices. We also have the removal of limitations that we currently have in group certification and multi-sites, for example, the limit of 500 group members that can be part of a group, that part is removed. And also the limitation of having to be based in the one single country. When it comes to multi-sites, we also have, for example, the possibility of sharing credits across countries, which were currently not allowed. And there's a few other changes related to the workers' rights, but as we also have Emily today with us, maybe I will let her deep dive into it.
Before I pass on to Emily, you said one of the magic words in FSA these days. All three of us were just at the International General Assembly a few weeks ago, where we heard a lot about this simplification of the FSC system and making it easier. Can you touch upon what simplification means in practice when we talk about the chain of custody revision? Are we simplifying everything beyond what you said, simplifying some of the actual requirements? Are we also simplifying some of the processes, the structures, et cetera?
So there's two dimensions to this, actually. So one is the actual requirements that apply to the company, which often, and as you were pointing to, it's related to the administrative burden that the company may have. And the other is how the user interacts with the standards. So on the first one, we saw the possibility of including more risk-based approaches in some situations. That's part of the simplification. That, of course, that will shift the focus to the geographic areas or products with reported integrity concerns. And with the last part that I was referring to, although we have to follow a formal kind of language when we write the requirements, we can still impact on how the requirements are presented and how specific they are. And outside of the standards, there's numerous options how we can explain things and guide the users to the intended purpose of each section. We are also considering related to this, developing a web-based version, which the user will be able to interact with, to choose the applicable sections according to their scope of activity, and having all the auxiliary information centralized in one place.
Okay, I have a lot of follow-up questions for that. Risk-based approaches inside the chain of custody, would that then apply primarily in the standard which is applicable for the auditors so that they know where to focus? Or is it something that when you actually are a certified company, you can define, well, this is my risk area, so therefore I don't need to handle these indicators, for example? How are we dealing with that?
So it's both, actually, because some of the requirements that are applicable to auditors, they are also reflected, or we try at least to make them consistent with the requirements that we have when you establish a multi-site and a group. So if in principle you are allowed as an auditor to make a remote audit to a company, which for sure will have some savings in terms of resources, whether human or financial resources, the same logic applies when you have to do your internal audits within your company. Similar thing would be when it comes to how to count the materials that are from its origin. They are pre-consumer reclaim material. We are testing whether we can give a claim contribution or recognition to such type of material. And just by that, we remove a lot of the processing that needs to happen in the relevant standards, which initially or currently, we are saying that you have to know exactly the amounts of pre-consumer reclaim material, of post-consumer material. And if you are not sure, you need to do supplier audits. If we go down that route, that we give the same kind of recognition to both type of products, then you don't need to do all of those steps. The risk-based approach is being implemented very specifically on situations that we already know that there's low or likely to have a less risk from a system perspective.
Mm-hmm. And just a clarification, when we're talking pre-consumer here, we're talking pre-consumer paper, right?
We are talking about pre-consumer woods, actually.
Oh, okay.
Currently, we do have full claim contribution to a pre-consumer paper, but actually we are testing now and consulting with stakeholders whether we should give the same claim contribution to pre-consumer woods. So expanding to the entirety of the types of pre-consumer materials that we have.
Oh, well, I know a handful of companies that would be happy to hear this. I know that at one point you were also talking about collapsing all of these different standards. When you introduced them in the beginning, you were talking about three or four different standards. You've also been playing with the idea of collapsing them all into one. Is that still the case?
Yes. Yes. That's another thing that we are trying to test from a structure perspective, is that all of those standards that I mentioned, we merge everything together. So we reduce the number of points of reference. So essentially we centralize the requirements. And by that, we also reduce the duplications that currently exist between those standards, right? And that's actually what happened with this first draft. We reduced nearly by half the number of pages, but also because much of the informative kind of information that we had there are being moved away to guidance materials. So also we can change those and update those as we move forward more frequently.
So it sounds like that is in itself a major simplification on the horizon. And combined with this web interface, it might be a good way for certificate holders to more easily navigate. If you're just looking at what is on the table right now, and you've mentioned a lot of different potential changes, which of these changes would you think have the biggest daily operational impact for the companies who are actually certified, something that will really be noticed by the certificate holders or their auditors?
First and foremost, and picking up from the structural changes, not only merging everything together, but replacing some of the sections, some of the requirements from a user perspective. How do you read, how do you interpret a standard? If you are the certificate holder and it's your first time that you are interacting with that standard. So we did some shuffling there, so it's easier for people to implement according to the normal a sequence of implementing each section. That's one. The other one, I already touched upon it, which is multi-site and group certification. It will be much more flexible as we currently have with this draft. And this will increase the support for small enterprises. This will change essentially how central offices may do businesses. And when it comes to probably the new concepts, we will see FSC certification reaching new markets, such as, for example, renting or leasing, as we call it, which in itself is already a big change for those companies and the auditors that will be auditing those companies that currently are not part of FSC system.
And we have a full episode coming up on that. That's part two of this two-episode series. Okay. Well, Emily, I'd like to pull you in as well because you've been waiting really patiently until now. This is your first podcast in FSC, so welcome. You're also part of the revision process and your focus is the social requirements. So can you tell us a bit about what are the main updates or new expectations being considered in the social area?
Yes, thank you. In terms of social requirements and for requirements that relate to workers' rights, it's obviously been 5 years since our last kind of major revision, bringing in the FSC core labor requirements. And we've heard a lot from stakeholders in the past few years, especially on not wanting kind of major changes, but enhancing what we currently have and also condensing and removing repetition and obsolete references, because we've obviously had some new advice notes and interpretations since 2021 that have to be kind of condensed and integrated within this new revision. In terms of the biggest changes, I would say occupational health and safety has always been in the standard since 2014, but we have this update from the International Labour Organization and in their Declaration on Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work. They've included the safe and healthy working environment as a kind of key fundamental right. So we're updating what we currently have on occupational health and safety to provide some more kind of prescriptive requirements. And we're also integrating motions from our membership, which relate to occupational health and safety as well. So that's related to electing representatives to support workers on occupational health and safety. In addition to that, we also have a member motion on freedom of association, which is motion 50, 2021. And we've already had an interpretation on that last year, and we're really integrating that within our current requirements on freedom of association. We've also made some small changes in terms of the universal requirements, so child labour, forced labour, discrimination, that will align more with what we've had in terms of requests from stakeholders, interpretations on those. We're putting them into the clauses.
Can I ask you a follow-up question there? Because I know that one of the things that a lot of certificate holders, at least where I come from, have found a bit tedious is the self-assessment and completing a self-assessment when all of the things that they're required to do is actually already mandated by law and is very much implemented. Are we doing anything about that?
Yes, that's a good question. We have definitely taken that into consideration and also looking at other schemes and how they address workers' rights and how they have it in their systems. The self-assessment for us plays a crucial role for helping the auditor in terms of scoping the audit, what they should focus on. So we have tried to reduce in terms of the numbers of questions that organizations will have to answer. They won't have to go into huge detail on the laws that apply to them in terms of when they're conforming to what the requirements say. But they will have to kind of give more description on where the laws don't actually align with our requirements. They'll have to give more detail there. So the onus is definitely on more detail when they think that they're not conforming to our requirements. Related to that, the self-assessment being used as a kind of description for the auditor to go to the site and evaluate the conformity, we are providing a more risk-based approach, which is taking into consideration whether that country is low or high risk. And that should ease in terms of the evaluation and scrutiny that the auditor takes when evaluating organizations in countries that are deemed as low risk because they have the laws in place and those laws are implemented effectively on the ground. So there should be a difference, and there's definitely less information to provide on the self-assessment. But we do still see it as key to kind of document, yes, I'm committed to conforming to these requirements, and this is why.
I'm curious because Cesar said we will be doing a lot more guidance, a lot more instructions to companies as to what it is that we expect from them when they have to create basically their procedure, their description of how do we adhere to the FSC standard. Will we in that also differentiate so that it's easy to see, well, if you are in a high-risk country, this is what we expect. If you are in a low-risk country, this is what we expect.
I think as part of the implementation of the revision, so after it's gone through this two public consultations, we're definitely going to look at what the guidance we have at the moment is, how that's been useful to stakeholders or maybe not so useful. And then we will work to create something that is more user-friendly and provides that distinction between the levels of expectations on description, especially for the self-assessment. But yeah, as part of the process, we'll take into consideration all the comments within these various consultations and then work to create the guidance with stakeholder input is the plan.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like we're both strengthening the social requirements, but also at the same time simplifying them and making them a bit easier, perhaps. Can you talk a bit about why is it now that FSC is putting more strength in social requirements in the chain of custody system as well? Because the last time when it was introduced, it was really the first time that we had workers' rights in the chain of custody standard. Now we seem to be dialing it up a bit more. Why are we doing that now? And how does it connect to the rest of what we're doing in FSC?
Good question. I think it's always been part of COC, or at least from 2014, we had the policy for association commitment to workers' rights, and we had the occupational health and safety. In terms of why it's been brought in or being enhanced more in the recent years, I think there's a definite demand for it from organizations. There's also more legal requirements at the national basis that FSE can definitely support, because we're already asking our organizations to conform to our requirements or going beyond what's legally required of the companies. And I would say that we're kind of moving more towards focusing on not only the risk scenario in terms of mixing of certified materials, but we're also looking at all of the essential requirements of our sustainable certification scheme, and workers being a key dimension of that and key to the success of the whole system. The recent requirements in terms of FSC CLR, and then more recently the advice notes related to contractors and when our organizations are contracting their activities, we're just strengthening the system and also aligning with those changes in legal frameworks and from the International Labour Organization. So it's useful for everyone to build on what we have, but also make it straightforward for our organizations to meet and maybe go beyond what is legally required of them. In terms of where it fits in with the whole FSC system, we've also had this in forest management requirements, so we could see the changes within chain of custody to kind of reflect those and mirror those in some way, although the systems operate slightly differently. And it's also the social chamber is a key chamber within our governance system, and we're reflecting the member interests and putting more into how we treat workers as forefront of our changes within this revision. And it's also linked into the global strategy where we're trying to enhance and scale up workers' rights. So I think it all plays into that. But we definitely need to balance what the FSC certification is and what it's not. And we don't want to go towards being completely a social standard, because that changes the reason why certificate holders choose to be certified. So we're trying to balance different interests and make it practical for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And actually there you touch upon something that I'd love to follow up on, because you said before that in some places we will be going beyond what is legally required of companies. And I can't help but wonder what stakeholders' response has been to the fact that we are now posing stricter and stricter workers' rights requirements. Is that well received by our certificate holders and our stakeholders? Are they ready for FSC to take on this task? Or what has the reaction been that you've been on the receiving end of?
I think with all changes, there's lots of questions and concerns. But I think definitely in most countries in the world, there is a move towards these changes. So whether our certificate holders find it, I mean, they might find it difficult to begin with, but hopefully they're presented in a way that are kind of doable and practical. And therefore, if they make the changes now, probably in a few years' time, there will be other requirements from different systems or from their suppliers or customers that will mean that they'll already have made those changes. And therefore, it's seen as a positive step. And I don't think this applies to that many countries in the world. It's more just a few here and there.
Are there any parts of social requirements that you wish you were able to include in this revision process, but which you couldn't at this stage?
So that's a good question. I think I'm always thinking on what does FSC certification mean, and it could be easy to add lots of requirements and make it into a social standard. And if you look at S8000 or other schemes, there's a lot more indicators to meet, but then also the audited time and the investment and time resource, etc., for the organizations would be way higher and burdensome. So we're trying to create this balanced approach with the requirements that we have at the moment, and specifically on audit time and resource, and also being risk-based. In terms of things that maybe I would choose to kind of elaborate on would be working times and wages, have more defined requirements for those. But again, that would move us more towards a social standard. And also those elements are already partly covered within the forced labor requirements. So they are covered in a way. It's just more, we could add on top of them, but that would then be more burdensome for the organizations and not necessarily where we would want to go.
Okay, so it sounds like you're actually pretty happy with what you were able to get into the revision this time around.
Yeah, I think we've worked well. We have a working group of experts from both the business side certification body and also the trade unions. And so we've tried to consider all interests and stakeholders and users of the standard. We have had some disagreements on some things, but I think the key was to enhance what we had there and to try and clarify and simplify. And I think with the changes that we're proposing, there should be some positivity from the stakeholders. Definitely in terms of the evaluation is going towards a more risk-based approach, which is hopefully appreciated.
I am very sure that at least in the countries that I operate in, that will be very welcomed. Cesar, returning back to you, this is the first of two episodes, and we'll be covering a lot more details in terms of what is going on in the reclaimed material standards in the next one. The reason why we're doing these podcasts is, of course, because we will open a public consultation on the first draft really soon. If you're a certificate holder out there or just a stakeholder out there and you want to participate in this, what do you do? Where do you go? How do you provide input that's actually helpful for you and the whole team behind this revision?
Yeah, so the place to go is FSC consultation platform that you can search for yourself, or even if you are a member or you signed up for the interested stakeholder email regarding the chain of custody revision, we will also receive an email with a link for you to access directly to this consultation platform. Just to remember that the consultation will start on the 15th of November and it will run until the 25th of January, early next year. And this is the first round of consultation. So it's the first time that we are presenting the ideas that we, in the past, we consulted, but the requirements were not still there. Now they are in the written form, and we will read and listen to our stakeholders. We will go back to our working group meetings. We will reflect on the arguments from stakeholders, and we will open a second consultation in quarter two next year in preparation for the final draft. In the meantime, you may also hear more updates from the network partners or even from the respective certification body.
Mm-hmm. So if I didn't go to the consultation platform, I open up the revision process. It's probably a massive document I'm faced with. Do I have to go through all the section or can I skip to the parts that's interesting for me?
So yes, it's a massive document, but no, you don't have to read and answer all. So the consultation is divided into sections connected to the sections of the standards itself. So you can choose the sections that you would like to provide feedback. If you are more interested in stakeholder in the workers' rights, you have a specific section for it. If it is about circularity and reclaimed materials, you have a specific section for it. Overall, we also provide kind of a crosswalk document in connection to the questions that we are asking. So stakeholders can see the key changes per section and then to choose whether they would like to provide their feedback on it. But more than agreeing or disagreeing, I would say that for us is more important that we actually receive the argumentation, the reason why you agree, the reason why you disagree, because that's essential for then the working group to take into consideration while preparing for the next stages of the process.
And are they equally important, the ones that agree and those that disagree? I mean, should you take the time to actually also explain why you agree to a change? Or is it better that you just skip to the parts where you're thinking, this isn't really good?
The reason why you agree or disagree is always important because it's not only quantitative basis. It's not just by numbers. It's not the majority that will influence a decision from the working group. So it's actually critical for us, more than the number itself, is what is the reason for preferred course of action or the other. And that's what actually we use to inform the discussions with the working group. So equally is helpful for us to have the justification for agreement or disagreement.
And what happens after the consultation closes in late January? It sounds like everything then goes back to the working group. What if I took the time, I replied to you guys, do I get an answer on my particular comment or how do I follow the process from there?
Yeah, so we will prepare a report. So as you may expect, we expect we will have hundreds of stakeholders participating. So it's not possible a one-on-one that I provide an answer directly to you. But what we will do is to prepare a report condensing the key topics or the key justification that was used. And later on a second stage, we will complement that report with the course of action that was eventually chosen by the working group. So in each consultation, there's always one report with the key themes, key justification, and then the course of action later that was chosen. So you can then choose between one consultation or the other, whether you need to keep focusing your arguments, your feedback into those areas, or you can simply move away to other sections.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So just to recap timeline for those out there who may want to follow this, but who may also just be really interested in when does all of these updated requirements hit me and my company. So we have a consultation coming up now, starting November 15th until end January. What happens after that? And when does this standard go into effect?
So as I said, second consultation around May 2026. After that, we will prepare the final drafts and start what we call the decision-making process. If everything is okay, it will be approved in 1 year time, end of 2026. And hopefully we can publish the revised standard on the 1st of January 2027. According to our regular procedures, the standards will only be effective on the 1st of July 2027. So there's a 6 months gap between publication and effectiveness. But then companies will have 18 months to make the transition, meaning adapting their procedures, the way of working according to the new set of requirements. So essentially, every single chain of custody certificate holder will have to adapt their systems by the end of 2028.
Okay. So there's time to adjust still. We only have a few more questions before we wrap this up, but I'd really like to just look a bit ahead into the future. And Cesar, I'll start with you. It really sounds to me like in this standard, we're not just in this revision process, we're not just focusing on the technical updates, but also on the simplification, on preparing FSC for the future, also with some of the extra topics that we're rolling into this. If you look a few years ahead, how do you hope that these changes that you're planting the seeds of now will actually help shape the way that FSC is perceived or is used in global supply chains?
Well, first, I hope that these changes bring value to companies. We need to be, as a system, be relevant for the market. And then also that the impact or the positive impact that the system deploys on the ground reaches new sectors with these new topics or clarity in those topics. And finally, I hope also that the standard keeps it relevance, its credibility in the global market as the best system, the forestry certification system. And where applicable, that's the standard also supports different types of compliance, whether commercial compliance with their buyers, whether regulatory compliance.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, I'd like to ask the same kind of question for you. How do you hope that the changes that you are heading up on the social side have helped shape supply chains in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, similar to what Cesar said, for the workers' rights things, we're always hoping that it retains protecting and upholding workers' rights across the whole globe, regardless of which country our certificate holders are in, and with the key of having workers at the center of sustainable supply chains. We're also hoping that with the changes we're making it more simple and straightforward, we can also encourage more small companies and companies that aren't currently in the system to join with the guidance and implementation help that we'll provide. More people will be in the system and therefore workers' rights are help across the world.
Mm-hmm. So if there's one big thing that you would like listeners to take away from this episode, what would that be?
I think the key thing for us in the revision process is hearing from stakeholders on what's important for them and the changes that we propose. And they have to take part in the consultation if we can make those changes applicable and suitable for them. So hearing detailed feedback and constructive comments from them would be really helpful for making us make a positive change and something sustainable for the future of FSC chain of custody.
A big thank you to Cesar and Emily for joining me and sharing your insights on what is coming in the revision of the chain of custody standard and why it's coming. Let's hope that Cesar gets his hope fulfilled when he hopes that the new version of the standard enables simplification and compliance for present and future regulations, as well as more access for even more companies than today, because we've made the rules easier to navigate and more risk-based in implementation. Let's also hope that Emily will see strengthened but also risk-based implementations of workers' rights become a reality, enabling even more companies, and especially the smaller companies around the world, to be part of FSC. If you want to dig deeper, you can follow the revision process on connect.fsc.org. I will also post direct links to the consultation in the show notes. We, of course, invite you to take part in the upcoming public consultation. Your input is very valuable to us, and it would really help us shape how FSC continues to evolve. In our next episode, we will continue the chain of custody conversation, but we will shift our focus to reclaimed materials and to how FSC is exploring circular business models, which is an exciting new area with huge potential for innovation and for impact. Until then, thank you for listening, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes. You can always reach out to me with comments or topic suggestions on podcast@fsc.org. I am Laura Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.